Okay. So David has just redefined the word volunteer. It has nothing to do with reality or what's in Webster's. I must say up front that I was interested in this field, but that was a long time ago. So what I will tell you is basically just very basic stuff, give you sort of some idea about where this came from, and as far as I know, why this is important for atomic and optical physics community. And then I will pass the stage on to Tilman Fow, who actually is an experimentalist working in this field. And those of you who were here this morning, he actually showed us some really nice data from the experiments that he has been involved in. So he's going to tell you about his perspective, being someone in the field rather than someone like me who's in the neighborhood of the field. So Bose-Einstein condensation, that's the the reason for this Nobel Prize. And in simplest terms, this is a very simple quantum statistical effect. So if you have a gas of atoms that have integer spin, we know that they are bosons. You can call it composite bosons, but they are pretty tightly confined, so we can, for all practical purposes, treat them as bosonic particles. And therefore, the distribution of particles, or the occupancy, will be a function of energy, of course, and will obey the usual Planck distribution, where beta is, of course, 1 over kT, and then we'll have energy minus chemical potential minus 1. Now, in these experiments, you have a situation where the total number of particles is fixed, and you have, or actually it's not quite, when I tell you about the experiment, but in the ideal scenario, you have a fixed total number of particles, and you envision changing the temperature by some means. And in that case, so what you can write here is the total number of particles, or total number of atoms, will be a simple integral over all energies times the distribution function and times the density of states. So this is that guy. And this will fix basically the chemical potential. And if you can have a scenario where for a finite T, that is for T larger than zero, you can set the chemical potential equal to zero, then the only way to accommodate the total number of atoms in the system would be that you will have a finite fraction of the atoms accumulating in one state, in the lowest possible state, plus a certain thermal cloud that will be distributed in the higher energy states. And that is Bose-Einstein condensation. So accumulation of a finite fraction of atoms in the lowest possible or the lowest energy state. Now, just a word of caution here is that, so what I've told you so far is a purely quantum statistical effect. Actually, if the particles were truly non-interacting, then there would be no reason for them in the thermodynamic limit, there would be no reason for them to accumulate in just one state, okay? So your density of states function will depend on energy in some way. The exact dependence is not so important. But of course, you can, there will be many states in the neighborhood of zero energy. And in principle, the atoms could be distributed over different states. This problem is solved when you introduce some weak interactions. Then it turns out that this fragmentation of the condensate becomes costly. And it becomes indeed the case that all atoms have to accumulate in one state. Okay, now why is this different? So we have known exactly, so this was of course first this anomaly was suggested by Bose in 1924, and in 1925 I think Einstein, after reading his paper, basically predicted that this effect will basically take place. Now, There has been other examples of physical phenomena within the last 50 years or so, or even dating before Bose-Einstein condensation prediction, which is closely related to the BEC experiments that was the reason for the Nobel Prize. And of course, these phenomena are superfluidity in helium-4, okay, and the other one is BCS superconductivity. Now, I remember that in 1995, after the first wave of experiments, there was quite a bit of criticism for the sort of uproar or the interest from part of the physics community, saying that, well, this is a phenomena that we know already, so why bother? I mean, why is this so interesting? Because indeed, the way to explain superfluidity in helium-4 is by assuming that the atoms do form a Bose-Einstein condensate. Now, there is, and also similar ideas can, one can also think of superconductivity as some sort of a condensate of Cooper pairs. Now, the main difference between these two regimes, the regime of atomic BECs and helium-4, is that the densities are extremely low and the interactions are much weaker. And the net result of that is the so-called hybridization that results in a small finite fraction in the condensate, in the lowest ground state in helium-4, is not the case for the atomic condensate. So in atomic condensates, we're talking about densities that are on the order of 10 to the 12 to 10 to the 14 atoms per centimeter cube. Okay, several orders of magnitude smaller. And actually, the total number of atoms ranges from, in the initial experiments, it was more like 2,000, and now it goes up to 10 to the 7th. Okay? So, and basically, I mean, as far as I know, in the experiments, one can reach a regime where more than 90% of the particles are indeed in the ground state, to condense in the ground state of the system. Now, this, of course, is just a quantity. You can argue that this is a quantitative difference. I think why these condensates are interesting for physics in general is that it's very easy to control and manipulate them. You can use laser fields, magnetic fields to change several parameters. For example, you can change the interaction strength that governs the dynamics of the condensate. You can change it from being a repulsive interaction to a non-interacting system. You can even make it an attractive interaction. And this can be done by simply changing the strength of a magnetic field. I mean, I'm not saying that the experiment is simple, but just conceptually, it's a change of the magnetic field strength. Also, you can use laser manipulation to slice condensates, recombine condensates, look for interference effects, try to look for effects like matter wave amplification that Tillman described this morning, where you send in a bunch of atoms and you increase the number of atoms in the condensate, much like what you do in laser amplification for photons. So there are a number of things that can be done that wouldn't be possible in the other examples. And of course, Josephson effect, or the analogs of this, is another thing that you can observe. And that's what comes to my mind now. Okay, so theoretically, actually, I think I would say, at least as far as I know, that this hasn't been terribly exciting, and I might be wrong on this. This is my perspective on this. So it turns out that the condensate, so you can use the traditional techniques of treating, sort of the simplest way of treating these systems is to use a mean field approximation. So what you do is you write the field operator. So this is field operator that annihilates an atom at point r at time t. You can write this as some condensate wave function times an operator that annihilates an atom in the condensate ground state plus some fluctuation term. And in the mean field, what you assume is that the mean value of this guy does not vanish. So that corresponds to assuming a coherent state for the condensate ground state. Actually, there is no reason to assume that that is indeed the case here. And I think most people think that the condensate wave function looks more like a Fock state, where you will just have n particles all in the same lowest energy state. But it turns out that that really does not matter. You can assume that this mean value does not vanish. And you can write an equation for this mean value starting from the Heisenberg equations, which gives you the celebrated Gross-Pitayevsky equation. And so it's a nonlinear Schrodinger equation, H bar del phi del t. Okay. I guess I don't even need to write this. You have a trapping potential here, and then you have the nonlinear term that you have to take care of. And it turns out, at least within the first few years that I really followed the literature, almost all the phenomena that was observed experimentally were quite nicely described by this mean field approach. And then, of course, you have to look at the excitation spectra starting from this description, sort of go up in hierarchy to describe the excited modes. And the agreement with the experiments were quite good. There were attempts at developing quantum kinetic models, basically more analogous to what we are used to in quantum optics, master equation type approaches for describing the condensate dynamics, which it turned out to be too complicated. I think there were some numerical analysis carried on with those and which predicted, which were consistent with the experimental observations. But most of the theoretical activity, I would say, at least within the first few years, was based on this mean field approach. Now, as far as I know, again, there is one new development within the last 2 years on the observation of vortices, which seems to have discrepancies when compared to these approaches. Basically, the people, several groups have observed very nice vortex lattices in VECs, and their lifetimes are much longer than what has been predicted based on these more sort of simple theoretical models. So maybe there are some theoretical surprises there, which again I haven't really followed, so I'm not able to say. So this is my perspective. So let me tell you how these experiments work, why this was so interesting and so much celebrated. So I think part of the reason is there has been a tradition in atomic physics, or at least a group of atomic physicists have been involved in precision measurements. So back in 70s, for example, several of the names that you know and associate with BEC work now were involved in precision measurements or tests of quantum mechanics. And these include Ted Hensch, Steve Chu, Carl Wieman. Now, I think there was a logical sort of next step in these precision measurements, which were initially based on manipulating the internal degrees of freedom of atoms to increase the precision. One needed to have a control over the external degrees of freedom. And in this context, laser cooling was first proposed back in 1975, I think, by Ted Hensch and Arthur Shallow, and I think independently by Hans Demelt and Dave Wineland, who is another person who is very well known, at least in the quantum information community. So then the experiments in the 80s basically pushed the limits of laser cooling, and there were several surprises, I mean several incidences where experiments worked better than what was thought to be theoretically possible. And in the end, though, I think laser cooling techniques alone, and there are several techniques. The simplest one is Doppler cooling, which I will just briefly explain. And polarization gradient cooling is actually a in my opinion, is a variant of this that basically explains why you can do better than the limits that are imposed by Doppler cooling. So the point that I'm trying to make is, this is 1970s. In 1980s, it was laser cooling, pushing the temperatures down to several microkelvin regime. Okay, this was still a couple of orders of magnitude higher than what is needed for quantum degeneracy, and that last step came in 1995, or in 1990s when people started to combine laser cooling with another technique, which is called evaporative cooling, which was, I think, first suggested or proposed by Dan Kleppner. Is that right, Tilma?
Paper by Hess. He was working in the Kleppner group.
Okay, so this was actually proposed, I think, in the context of cooling hydrogen to degeneracy, where laser cooling techniques do not apply. And in the end, it turned out that these two needed to be combined. So what is the story here? So let me again briefly describe to you. So Doppler cooling idea is relatively simple. So if you have an atom which can be moving, let's consider the one-dimensional case only, in either direction, and let's say it's bombarded by laser light that is red detuned. Okay, so if this is the atomic transition energy, atom is in the ground state, laser is tuned to an energy that is lower than the atomic transition. Now, if the atom moves towards this laser field, then it sees a frequency shift due to the Doppler effect, which goes as k dot v, where this is the v of the atom. Okay? So it comes into closer to resonance with this guy as compared to that guy, because compared to this laser field, it moves away from resonance. So it will be more likely to scatter or absorb a photon from here and turn it into a spontaneously emitted photon. And what happens then is, of course, it gets initially a momentum kick as it absorbs from this laser photon, which has a well-defined momentum. But when it emits a photon, it's going to emit into opposite directions with equal probability, which means that in average, as a result of absorption emission event, it will get a kick, momentum kick of h bar k in the direction that is opposing its motion. And this is the basic idea, I think, behind Doppler cooling. This can be combined with the trap, and that's a magneto-optical trap. So I'm pretty bad in drawing things, but the idea here is that you have two coils. I think this is called anti-Helmholtz coil. So you have two currents flowing in opposite directions. That means that you have a region here with zero magnetic field. And again, you have the same atom. And we are also going to assume that it has an internal structure. So basically, we can assume that it has a J equals zero ground state and J equals one excited state. So instead of having just one state here, we will have two states. And we will have counter-propagating circularly polarized laser field. And I might be getting these wrong in terms of the coincidence of the current direction and the sense of polarization of the photons. But the main idea is, if an atom moves in, say, one direction, these laser fields would again be red detuned. Okay, so it either tries to couple this guy to that guy, or this guy to that guy. And if the atom moves in this direction, then this guy gets shifted down, or it's probably the opposite way, and the atom is more likely to scatter these photons and will be pushed back to its original place. It moves in the other direction, then it sees a magnetic field in the opposite direction. This guy moves in to smaller detunings, and then it will be pushed in the other direction. You can combine this with laser fields from all three dimensions, and that will create you a so-called magneto-optical trap, a idea first proposed by Jean Dalibard and first realized by Pritchard and Steve Chu in 87. So this will be a way to cool and trap atoms. And this is the first step in BEC experiments. So you first collect a number of atoms. I think it's in the billions or so. Is that a right number? In this volume, and you cool them down in the process to about 10 microkelvin temperatures. Then there might be some intermediate steps, but again, roughly speaking, the step is to turn the laser fields off and create a purely magnetic trap. So the magnetic trap can provide a harmonic confinement for the atoms, and of course this is the place of zero B field, and as you move away you will have higher B fields. So then the idea is to trap the atoms in this magnetic trap and then apply an RF field. And the RF field is such that if the atoms have enough energy so that their excursion, they can go out to regions where they see high magnetic fields, then they will be resonant with spin flip transitions. And it will be only certain magnetic sublevels that will be trapped by this guy. So for example, for rubidium, you will have, instead of the F equals 1, F equals 2 usual manifold, you will have these, I'm off here, okay. So you will, for example, this guy and this guy will be trapped, whereas these other guys will not be trapped. So you can basically, if you're trying to make a condensate here, you can cause a spin flip transition that takes you from here to there or there, and those atoms will not be trapped and will simply leave. Now, the idea is, of course, only the atoms that can go out into this region of high magnetic field will see this resonant process, whereas the lowest energy atoms will not. Their wave function will not extend that far, and therefore they don't see these resonant flip processes. So basically this is a way to remove the hot atoms. And if you have enough scattering within the gas that thermalize what remains, then you can effectively remove lower your temperature. Of course, you also lose atoms, but it has been shown, at least definitely experimentally, that you can increase your phase space density with this process by selectively removing the hot atoms. So this was the second step. So laser cooling plus evaporative cooling allows you to get to this degeneracy regime where BEC effects start to become important. One obstacle, if I remember correctly, was this B equals zero point, because at this point the atoms are not trapped, and this would be and these are all have equal energy, and this was regarded as a loss mechanism at the time. So basically what made the difference in the original experiment was a way to combine these magnetic trapping with the way to fill this hole so that the atoms, even at this point, will feel a finite magnetic field or will be repelled from this region. So the idea of the Eric Cornell and Dave Weinmuth was to use a time-dependent magnetic field, and the atoms, this was moving fast enough that the atoms saw a sort of an average magnetic field at this point. And for Wolfgang Ketteler, he basically introduced a laser field that pushed atoms away from the origin so that they would never see the zero magnetic field region. And that was the initial experiment. Actually, later on, Wolfgang came up with another trap geometry, which didn't have a hole to begin with. And I think that that has become more of less of an industrial standard. There are now, I think, about 15 or 20 groups doing experiments in this field. I will show you this this graph from Wolfgang Ketterle. So there were actually two phase transitions in this field. One is in atoms, the other is in the number of papers. Basically, if you look at number of papers that are published in this field up until 1995, the number was, I think, on the order of 10, 5 to 10. And here there was really a jump and then a continuous increase. And now it seems to be leveling off around 100 or so. So this was almost like a real phase transition. And it's still increasing, so it hasn't started to come down yet. But definitely, the amount of activity in this field has increased dramatically. And I think for the first 2 years, actually, there were only two groups which were able to make BECs, the Ketterle group and the Cornell-Wyman group. Now, as I said, there are about 20, and many groups are now looking into what can be done with condensates rather than getting a condensate. And there are some interesting results. Unfortunately, we don't know much about this. There's a very recent result, for example, on the observation of Mott-insulator transition. And this, again, Tillman can say more about this, but the idea here is to start with the BEC and then impose an optical lattice on that BEC that basically localizes atoms in different lattice sites separated by optical wavelength. This was actually first, the idea was developed 3.5 years ago here at ITP by Peter Zoller, and it seems like the Munich group has succeeded in observing this, but this is very, very new. So we don't have data or much about this. So, I guess that's basically what I have to say. So if you have questions, otherwise I will pass the stage on to Tillman. All clear? Or? Okay, so you want to tell about the atomic physics? Or?
I'm just curious that you covered basically everything that can be said. Maybe I can. Do I need to use this? Or?
Should you use it?
Yes.
The other way, maybe that can do it. Okay.
Of course, I'm willing to answer any question concerning technical details of the experiment, but I guess that's maybe not your main focus here. Maybe I would comment a little bit on the things that lie ahead of us, what I believe, why this is of importance not only for our community, but maybe for other communities as well. Now, for our community, as you said, really, it was all motivated by, say, precision measurements that are usually spectroscopic measurements, laser spectroscopy, say, on simple atoms as hydrogen, asked for better and better precision to learn about the effects of QED that form the structure in the hydrogen atom. There are other quests in precision measurements, like measurement of the fine structure constant or H bar over M, or efforts that are looking at possible dipole moments of electrons or elementary particles that can be tested with high precision spectroscopic setups. And a limiting factor in all of them, at some point at least, were Doppler effects due to the finite temperature. And so that was a motivation, at least for the early stage here. And I should say that you described these two cooling steps, and both of them are really, in retrospect, sort of miracles that happened, because in both cooling steps, you are gaining many, many orders of magnitude. Here you're gaining, first of all, many orders of magnitude in temperature. You're cooling down basically from room temperature to the microkelvin regime, which is sort of miraculous that you can really get this to work, and that was the reason for the Nobel Prize, I guess, 97. And a similar miraculous thing happens with evaporative cooling. You might say you throw away atoms by the mechanism that you described, namely you induce RF spin flips here, and that way you are losing atoms. And that's true. You're actually losing about 99% of the atoms that you initially trap in this magnetic trap. Nevertheless, the phase space density increases by 6 to 7 orders of magnitude while you are doing this. And why is this the case? Well, as you are lowering the temperature, you are also increasing the density, because the atoms in such, say, a harmonic trap accumulate more and more in the center. And this is a three-dimensional harmonic oscillator. And although you are throwing atoms out by cooling them through the thermalization processes, you are increasing the density. And you are lowering the temperature, so phase-based density goes up, and it's a self-accelerating process. So the difficult part in experiment is to get this self-accelerating process going. Once it's going, you have basically won, and it will start to condense.
Why is it self-accelerating?
Because if the density, the limiting factor is the thermalization rate that goes with the density and the relative velocity and the cross section. So as you are increasing the density by throwing atoms out, you are accelerating the thermalization, and therefore you can ramp down, that's what happens in this experiment, the threshold energy that decides which atoms to take out. Once it is in this so-called runaway regime, it really runs away down all the way down to Bose-Einstein condensation. Maybe one could add, why is it not possible, at least up to now, with all optical means, say in the sense that you would maybe cool the atoms already by laser cooling directly to the Bose-Einstein condensation? Well, there are limiting processes here in the laser cooling having to do with the fact that as the samples get more dense, the scattered photons can get reabsorbed by the neighboring photons, and the samples get basically optically thick. And at that point, any photon that you send into the sample, or that is created within the sample, gets scattered many times and heats up the cloud again. And so the balance of that ends up in a normal magneto-optical trap to limit the density and the temperature to phase-based densities of 10 to the minus 6 in units of, I mean, of 10 to the minus 6, where 1 or 2.6 or something is the phase transition point for BEC. So, right. Now, maybe the why was it not obvious that it would work? And one should maybe say a word about that as well. One should realize that in order to get to achieve BEC, the collisional properties of the atoms have to work out the way they work out, actually. And it was, I think, a visionary, or how you say, the people like Wolfgang Kettele and also Carl Wieman, they saw that there is a gap in the collisional properties that would allow exactly what happened right now, namely that the two-body collisions that are responsible for the thermalization, that you need to do this evaporative cooling. So the elastic two-body collisions happen at rates that are accessible, but the killing three-body collisions that happen at slightly higher densities are not yet too severe. That's actually the limiting factor for the densities. You quoted up to 10 to the 14 atoms per cubic centimeter as a density in such a condensate. If you go higher, then three-body recombination as an inelastic process will kill you. And it was, as I said, I think really due to those guys that got the prize now, that they realized that the densities that are required for this cooling process to work are compatible and still within the range of what is possible to reach BEC without destroying the sample before reaching BEC due to three-body collisions. I think that's that motivated them, and that was sort of not understood in many other labs, I think. When you have three-body collisions, molecules form, and that's an inelastic process. There's so much energy involved in that all the collisional partners are lost, basically. Whereas in two-body collisions, well, at least there could be spin-flip collisions, but at least otherwise, then these collisions are just elastic collisions, which are good collisions.
How long is the list of atoms that this works for at all?
Okay, the first experiment in the JILA was a rubidium experiment, and Wolfgang Kettler's experiment is a sodium experiment. There was an experiment by Randy Hewlett at Rice University that is at least presented conclusive results in 1997. They have a first publication actually between the Cornell Wyman paper and the Kettler paper, which actually, the first publication was in the New York Times, as far as I remember, and only later it was accepted and also published in Physical Review Letters. But it turned out to be a heavily debated paper and it was considered not to be conclusive. And only 2 years later, they could sort of deliver some results on lithium. That was an experiment on lithium. Now, the interesting point about lithium is that it has an attractive interaction. The scattering length in lithium is a negative, and that means that the condensate on first sight might not be stable, right? It could just, under this attractive interaction, collapse and disappear. And what they found out is that, yes, that's what's happening, but not quite, because there are, in such a confined trap, there is a, if you like, quantum pressure that keeps the atoms apart. The zero point energy, or say the finite size of the ground state, can be considered as an effective outward pressure that counteracts the attractive interaction, and you can, by that simple consideration, come up with a limit in the number of atoms that is finally stable in such a trap, which is about a few 1,000 or 2,000 atoms, and that's exactly what they observed in their experiment. Now, after that, there was an experiment in hydrogen. Finally, they realized a condensate in hydrogen. One should say in that respect that these guys, I mean, Kleppner is the one activity, and Wallrafen in the Netherlands is the other activity there. This activity started much earlier, like in the 70s. So when laser cooling and so on was really, really at the very, very early stage, if almost not developed at all. Now this is an approach that is solely based on, first of all, cryogenic cooling and then evaporative cooling, and was experimentally very tough. I mean, it's a very, very difficult way of creating cold gases. But finally, in 97, I believe, or no, wait a minute, 97 or 98, they succeeded in getting a condensate in spin-polarized hydrogen at MIT. Now, the difference there is that the numbers of atoms in the condensate are much higher because they are working with large volume traps, and so they have typically 10 to the 9 atoms. The difficult part there is, again, you don't have all the nice imaging techniques to image the hydrogen cloud. They are doing these experiments with say, more indirect detection mechanisms like spectroscopic information and so on. Then what is also interesting is the condensate in rubidium-85. Well, the first one was rubidium-87, which has a repulsive interaction and is nowadays the standard workhorse in the field and sort of is the most easy atom to work with. Much more difficult to work with is the other isotope, rubidium-85, because it has initially an attractive interaction, which again provides prevents you from forming large stable condensates. But in addition to that, the collisional properties don't work out favorably. There are, as function of temperature, or meaning relative energy in the collision, there are actually energies where the collisional cross-section goes through a zero. And that sort of will bring this process to a halt. It will stop at that temperature if you don't do anything about it. And it was then again the Weimann group that by using a Feshbach resonance, which is a process that can change the scattering length by applying external magnetic fields, overcome this barrier leading to a condensate, quite small, a few thousand atoms only, but having now the option to tune the interaction strength in a condensate. So what they are doing is, for example, they produce a stable condensate with repulsive attraction, and then at T equals zero, they switch the magnetic field and on purpose let it collapse and study collapse times and the products of that collapse and so on. Next interesting condensate is the metastable helium one, I guess. There are two metastable helium condensate now in Paris, one in the group of Alain Aspy and one in the group of Cohen Tanucci and at the École Normale. The remarkable thing there is that the atoms themselves are not in their ground state. They are in the triplet excited state, so they carry 20 electron volts internal energy, which is a huge amount of energy compared to the temperatures that we are talking about. And you might wonder, why is this energy not released during all of those collisions? And that is a surprising thing. I mean, the argument that I had before, that two-body collisions could mainly only be elastic and thermalizing collisions, doesn't hold for helium anymore, because two of those atoms have enough energy to ionize even one of the collisional partners. That's called a Penning collision. Now, the miracle there is that if you spin polarize the helium, then due to conservation of angular momentum in such a collisional process, this Penning collision can be substantially suppressed. And again, it's five orders of magnitude suppression in the respective rate constants that allow these guys to, despite this killing process, basically reach the condensation point and observe a condensate with metastable helium. Yes, please?
Yes. Remind us the lifetime of the atomic state, the natural lifetime.
The natural lifetime of the metastable state?
Yes.
Oh, that's like thousands of hours. It's very long. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's not the problem, but that holds for an isolated atom.
Yes.
If there's a next one nearby, okay, then usually that's what happens. It destroys the perfect symmetry and leads to a ionization, basically. So that's the helium. The reason there's a condensate in potassium as well, that's another alkali atom in the Lorentz group.
No cesium.
Okay, and there's yet another cesium, and that shows what can happen, you know, what could have gone wrong in the very first place. I mean, that's maybe the fact that the first experiments were successful in rubidium and sodium is maybe also a little bit luck, because at that time all these collisional properties were not really known. And basically, the collisional properties that go in there, the scattering length, if you don't have a measurement in forehand, is a randomly chosen quantity. Okay. And in cesium, well, if you're interested, I can explain why this is the case, but I don't know whether this goes too much into detail. But it's like also if you do neutron scattering on some nuclei, there is a scattering length characterizing the strength of the S-wave scattering, and there can be resonances in such a scattering process. And where, so to say, you are, in whether you are away from these resonances or whether you are in a resonance that is pointing towards positive, large repulsive, or whether you are in a resonance pointing towards negative, large attractive interactions, depends on very small details of the molecular potential that was not known for either of those atoms when all of this started. So you could just guess basically that and hope that you are away from those resonances, and that's the case in rubidium and sodium. But in cesium, you are just, exactly on one of those resonances, and the cross-sections are gigantic, they are huge. You might, they are like a factor of 100 or 1,000 larger than in the other systems. And you might think that's good, right? I mean, you have large cross-sections, thermalization would go very fast and so on. But all of if you sit on the resonance, also the inelastic processes become very large and dominant and prevent from, in cesium, up to now, the creation of Bose-Einstein condensates.
And there are no systematic measurements of scattering lengths?
Now there are for exactly those atoms that condense, but there are no systematic measurements for other atoms that might be of interest. Only now we have these values for the scattering lengths in rubidium and all the other elements that have been condensed. But if you pick a random atom out of the periodic table, you know something about the molecular potential. But what decides on whether the scattering length is positive or negative is the detailed energy of the very last bound state in this molecular potential with respect to the dissociation limit. And that is, with this precision, none of the molecular potentials are known, except now for the ones that have been studied in that context. So I would say in that context that rubidium, for example, is the best known atom that we have at all in terms of that we know all about the collisional processes at low temperatures now. Okay, right, so we went through the list of atoms that have been condensed. Did I forget anything there? I don't think so. I got all of them, I think, yeah. But there are other experiments underway where one tries to create condensates in yet other species in order to do to make use of their properties. I can comment on that in a little while. I wanted to maybe draw a little picture on. Maybe I can create this.
You called on cooling fermions.
Yeah, that's the next. I wanted. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So where does it go now? So first of all, it's of interest in itself, of course, to investigate those condensates and. We have already talked about the collisional physics that benefits from that, and we have learned quite a lot about collisions, cold collisions especially, in that context, which are purely quantum collisions in the sense that are at those temperatures, the bosons are scattered through pure S-wave scattering. Okay. Then there's a whole branch of, I would say, optics. Yes. Because if you have a condensate, and you were mentioning already, you can look at this in full analogy what you're doing with in laser physics, say. You have a wave function psi here, and if you take this as an amplitude to optics, then you can take your optics book and basically go through all the phenomena that you know from optics, starting from linear optics, doing diffraction experiments, building interferometers, going to nonlinear optics. The term that you mentioned, the nonlinear term in the Gross-Pityaevsky equation, is nothing else than a Kerr nonlinearity in optics. And it has been nicely demonstrated, for example, in the four-wave mixing experiments that were done by Bill Phillips at NIST. The formation of the condensate due to stimulated processes, stimulated collisional processes, have very much in common with the way a laser works, namely that stimulated emission processes condense photons into a certain mode of a cavity. Now here the mode is the ground state of that trap, and it's just a question of how to couple it to the outside world and to couple atoms out of that to form a atom laser beam. So you have a, if you take bosons and you couple something out, you can look at it as a pulsed atom laser beam. Okay, but as you say, I mean, there are activities now underway with fermions, and there's a degenerate Fermi gas at JILLA in the group of Debbie Jin and potassium. And in the field of optics, there is no analogy now. So what is it if you take a degenerate Fermi gas and couple something out? That's a new object in optics, I would say, and so it sort of brings optics, brings new things to modern optics. That's certainly true.
How degenerate are they? I mean, the temperatures compared to the...
What they have achieved so far is 0.2 of the Fermi temperature as a temperature in their degenerate gas. And it would be nice to be even lower than that, because then pairing mechanisms might occur, and you could investigate new phase transitions in the fermionic system. So that is something that.
What atoms are you using?
Sorry, for the fermions,
yeah.
Potassium. So this has. So I would say in general that's condensed matter, yes. Or solid state physics. So condensed matter that is also affected by the work on, say, vortices, vortex lattices. Superfluidity has been addressed and maybe understood in a new context, and that is of interest for all those people. In solid state physics, really what we are just starting to experience or to explore now is what happens if you put this condensate, or maybe later on even fermionic gases, into periodic lattices that are perfect. We can build up lattices by interfering, say, two laser beams, and it's a one-dimensional lattice, four laser beams, it's a two-dimensional, and six laser beams. The three-dimensional, say, perfect cubic lattice with no defect, which are well suited for theoretical description. And we can do so with atoms that have a temperature T almost equal to zero Kelvin. So it's really the pure situation that you can investigate. First thing that has been observed, of course, are Bloch oscillations for the non-interacting system. That has already been observed without BECs, actually. If you have very cold atoms that have a large coherence length but are not yet condensed, you can still already occupy Bloch states in the periodic lattice and observe Bloch oscillations. But now the question is, what happens if you switch on some interaction? And then, of course, highly correlated states can occur. These are these quantum phase transitions, mod insulator transition, but maybe in this future also super solids and so on can be investigated. Finally, well, there are lots of things, but the other thing that I can discuss is, because it's relevant here, is quantum information, yes. We have a system, say, almost at T equals zero. The coherence times are tens of seconds. We have ways to define qubits. It's a two-level system. Say the hyperfine structure in the alkalis is a well-suited qubit that has a long coherence time. The BEC produces, of course, a cloud of indistinguishable atoms that, first of all, are in the effective single particle wave function that is microscopically occupied. So before you can talk about individual qubits, that you can address and that you can do some computation with, you have to make them distinguishable again. And but that's exactly the physics of this mode insulator transition, right? If you make this transition, the picture that you might have is that you have a transition from a superfluid phase, which is a microscopically occupied delocalized Bloch state, to a sum of Fock states, each of which localized at a lattice site, having no phase relation to its neighbor anymore. That means that as the phase fluctuations are increasing, the number of fluctuations at any site in the lattice are reducing, and that's why one calls it a Fock state, right? If you have a delocalized Bloch state over a lattice and you look at a specific lattice site, then at any site the number of atoms is fluctuating in a Poissonian manner. If you do this mod insulator transition, then these fluctuations in the number go to zero and you have a sample with distinguishable by the position, distinguishable atoms again that you later on might want to address to do some quantum logic operations here.
Still exchange processes that can go on even in the those atoms can switch positions.
Well, okay. The thing is that in these periodic lattices, we can vary the depth of that potential. Yeah. So as we start with a shallow potential, a load the condensate in there, we start with a superfluid phase. Then we lower the potential, and due to the interaction between the neighbors and the tunneling between the neighbors, this mechanism that leads to the mod insulator transition can take place. Then if you even lower this further, the tunneling can be completely neglected and you have really separated and isolated lattice sites, which is nice. And the densities work out the way that you would expect exactly one per a typical optical lattice site, or maybe two, not more. That's the perfect starting point, I guess, for further experiments along these lines. Well, and as you said, there are a million of these atoms, or millions of atoms. So in principle, the number of qubits that are available is very large. It's just a matter of whether we can handle it in the future experimentally, right? But we have large, the thing is, we have large coherence times, long coherence times. And there are proposals out there also from Peter Zoller, again, for gate operations that can be very fast on a microsecond time scale. So one might think that it could be possible to implement up to 10 to the 6 operations or something, which would be interesting. So that's another field that might become interesting, and now there are lots of things that one could add maybe at any of those spots. But I think the reason why it is worth a Nobel Prize is not because it's interesting for us. It's interesting for a whole bunch of physicists that are working on completely different issues, completely different fields, and I think that's how one qualifies for a Nobel Prize, I guess. Should qualify. I don't know whether I should continue or whether there are further questions. I can talk forever about this.
Any more questions? Well, I have a comment, and I would like to ask a very naive question. The comment is, it's a very interesting thing that happens when you have attractive bosons.
Yes.
It was done by Fritz London in the old days. And there are two things that limit it, even if there is no threat. One is that just the fact that they condense to very high density gives you kinetic energy to keep it at a finite density, which may be like 1/(1/(2) to the power, but it's a finite density for a finite number of atoms. Not to mention that if you get very close, you have Pauli repulsion between the atoms. So the atoms will never collapse.
Now they will form molecules in our case, right?
Do mm-hmm. something else. Mm-hmm. Now, the main question is this: one of the reasons that we like to go to new regimes is usually when you go to new regimes, you find new physics. And, when they first condensed helium, within quite a short time, superconductivity was discovered, supergravity was discovered, etc. And from what you guys said, I mean, there are a lot of very exciting things, but I mean, there is no sort of new physics observation that one could not write on paper before the experiment was done. Am I right or I miss something?
There are a few cases like the life and small, maybe detailed things that are so far maybe theoretically still under investigation, but I fully agree that most of the things that have been investigated, in principle, you can read many, the theory for that you can read in Landau-Lipschitz, right? But there are many things that are written in Landau-Lipschitz that have never been observed, right? And that one example is, as you mentioned, repulsive or attractive bosons. There is very early work, say, on one-dimensional system called the Tonks gas, right? Where you expect a chain of fermions to show the same physical behavior or same phase transition as a chain of repulsive bosons, basically, right? Now, this is a model system that solid-state physicists study, and this paper is from the 30s. But there has been no clear experimental environment to really check some of the predictions of that model. And that's one more example, maybe, for many of these things that are going on here. We just are sort of in a situation to make very clear experiments where we can distorted or deteriorated by dirt effects, defects, things that make life very hard, say, in solid state physics. That is the appealing thing. And I agree that so far there is not the discovery like that would shake the earth or understanding of whatever the world around us. It might change when it comes to application to precision measurement, really. There, I would say we have good reasons to believe that this development will push this into a direction that then also involves, say, high energy physics here, right? We are not that far yet, but it could become interesting to look for with spectroscopic techniques for predictions from that field that have not been possible before. One of which is the search for electric dipole moment in electrons, for example, that is predicted by beyond standard model theories. But that's still in the future to come.
All right. Actually, I was going to ask about what happens to the condensate when it collapses with the attractive interaction.
Okay, well, let's thank Adash.
Hello.